Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all this morning. I'm happy to be here. It feels like, somehow it feels like a long time since I've been here, but it hasn't been that long. But I know it's been a little while, at least more than 6 months since I gave a talk, because about 6 months ago, maybe some of you know my profession is I'm a musician, I'm a bass player. And I was teaching at a workshop in Kansas City in June, and hard to explain the exact circumstances, but anyway, I was carrying my bass. I was walking on a stage at a high school auditorium, so the stage was pretty high, like, you know, maybe 6 or 7 feet high, and I didn't see the edge, and I walked right off the edge of the stage carrying my bass, and it was kind of dramatic, you know. It was an enormous shock to me to have the ground just disappeared from under my feet. It was really, really something, a sensation I don't think I'll ever forget. I injured myself in a few ways. I got 12 staples in my head. So I learned a lot of things. The one thing I learned is that there's a special staple gun for heads. So I didn't know that before. And I sprained my left ankle pretty badly. But the main thing was that because I was carrying my bass, my right shoulder was really, injured. The bone was fractured and the cartilage around the bone was torn, and two tendons were not quite torn all the way, but almost. So I wasn't able to play. I still really can't play. It's been 6 months. I'm not really able to use my shoulder normally. Today I was able to put on my Ocasa by myself, so that felt like a that felt like a step in the right direction somehow. I don't know. So these last 6 months have been kind of a strange sort of like floaty period of time for me, where I have been completely unmoored from the thing that I have done since I was young, that sort of, you know, one of the things I use to define myself when people ask what, you know, who I am or what I do, that's what I would say. But it was strange. So it was really strange for 6 months to not be doing those things, and be unsure whether or not what was going to happen. The last two weeks I was, The main teacher who I've worked with as a bass player lives in France. So the last 2 weeks I was in France, mostly working with him, trying to get some insight into what's happening with my shoulder and how I can begin to play again. And it's really important. I realized about a month ago it was going to be really important for me to do that, because for me, playing music is a sort of an integral part of my, what can I say? It's an integral part of the way that I sort of relate to the world and relate to other human beings. And I have, over the time that I've been practicing Zen for about the last 20 years or so, more and more I've increasingly begun to see that work as a musician as a different kind of expression of the same kind of thing that I think is being manifested in Zazen practice. I guess it seemed possible to me, and it still seems possible to me, that maybe I won't be able to do that in the future in the way that I always assumed I would be able to for a long time. But I think I probably will. And because I think I probably will, it just seemed important to me to begin to investigate that a little bit more closely. Those of you who have been around Clouds for a while or around other Zen places know that music is not a central part of what we do, to say the least. I've had, you know, other musician friends come to visit Clouds or other places, and they leave, they're like, what's up? There's like, what's up with the chanting and the monotony and all, you know? It's not easy to explain. It's hard to explain my attraction to it as a musician. You'd think I would be more interested in, I don't know, Lutheran hymns or something, but I grew up with that, so I know that I do love them, actually, but... No, it was sort of some of my first spiritual experiences were, like, really powerful experiences were hearing the organ improvisations. You know, we had a great organist when I was a kid, and it's like, whoa. I thought, wow, okay, that's something for me anyway. So that's what's been going on with me the last few months. And one of the things that I've had the opportunity to do a couple things that I wouldn't have had time to do if I was playing music so much. One of the things that I'm not going to talk about much today, but has been really interesting, one of the things that I've been able to do is, for a long time, I've had the ambition to study classical Chinese. So I've been doing that on my own for the last few months, and it's been super interesting. And just one little interesting anecdote about that. So that I told my teacher, who's Japanese and can reads classical Chinese, I mentioned to him that I was doing that, and he's always sort of encouraged his students to think about trying to do something like that, because there aren't that many people translating texts from Chinese or Japanese into English. And I told him that I was beginning to work on that, and he thought it was a good idea, and he told me that when Buddhism moved from India to China, it took 800 years for them to translate all the texts that were translated from Indic languages into Chinese. 800 years. And that was, you know, I thought, okay, well, I guess there's work to do then. I won't run out of things to do. Okay, that's good. So I've been working on that, and just in a few months, you know, you don't, at least I don't, get very far in terms of, you know, being able to dream about translating things, but I do find it's kind of exciting. You know, I look at things and I'm like, oh, hey, I know what that means. So that's kind of cool. So I've had the time to do that, and I've had time to read and sit and think more about practice. I've been sitting a lot and thinking about what this practice is good for. Because there was a lot of despair for me, or, you know, that came with that injury, and I thought, man, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I still feel hopeless when it looks like a thing that I want is getting taken away from me, and it feels unfair, like it shouldn't be happening like this. On that topic, I want to share with you, and maybe talk, and I'm really interested to hear if people have responses or questions or whatever. I want to talk about some teachings in this book. It's called, I've talked about it a little bit before here, it's called The Zen Teaching, A Homeless Kodo. And this book is an important book for me for a bunch of reasons. One reason is that, so my teacher's name is Shohaku Okamura, and his teacher was Kosho Uchiyama, and Kosho Uchiyama's teacher was this guy who is called Homeless Kodo, or Kodo Sawaki. So there's a sort of direct connection in a few generations between me and Sawaki Roshi, who this book is sort of about and contains his teachings. He was a really interesting, unusual person. And I want to give a little context about who he was, because I think it's important in order to understand the tone of what he's expressing. When was he born? I don't know when. The late 19th century, the early 20th century, he was born in Japan. And his parents died when he was really young. I don't know, remember exactly how young, 4 or 5 years old. And he was adopted by this guy who was called his uncle, but wasn't actually his uncle. Who was a professional gambler, and this guy's wife, who was a former prostitute, and so they didn't have a super wholesome home life. And shortly after he was adopted by them, he was taken out of school and put to work for them. And sort of one of his primary jobs was sort of as a lookout for police and stuff like that. So from that time, he had, I think, through friends and other connections with friends and their families, he knew that this wasn't the life that he was hoping for. So as when he was a teenager, he left home and walked. I think for a couple days he walked to go to a Zen monastery, hoping to be ordained at Eheiji, which is the sort of central Soto Zen monastery in Japan. And he got there and learned that they don't ordain people at Eheiji. Eheiji is a training monastery. So he had to leave again, and he walked for a few more days and found another temple where he was ordained and practiced. And so he had sort of a bit of a rough and tumble kind of upbringing. He was a very tough, strong person. During the Russo-Japanese War, he enlisted in the military and was a war hero in that war, whatever that means. But in the end was actually, I think he was actually technically killed and died on the battlefield and was resuscitated, and then went on to sort of become a very, very well-known popular Zen teacher throughout Japan, partly because of his very unique way of expressing things about the Dharma. So this book was compiled, or a version of this book was compiled after he died, by his student Kosho Uchiyama. They're very short chapters. The chapters are one or two pages long, and these chapters were originally newspaper columns. A newspaper, I think, in Tokyo asked Uchiyama Roshi to, write something about his teacher after he died in 1965, I think. So I picked out a few that I find interesting, and I want to share them with you in some commentary about them and say some things I think about them, and I'm curious if anybody has reactions. This first one, the way maybe you, I don't know if you can see or not, you can sort of see there's this first section is what is by Soaki Roshi. Actually, it's not, but it's from Uchiyama Roshi's notebooks that he wrote down of things that he heard from him. And then the next section there is Uchiyama Roshi's commentary. And most of these chapters in this most recent edition, they all also have a commentary, a third section, written by my teacher. And I'll share some of that with you. So it's kind of an interesting multi-generational look at these questions. So Soaki Roshi said, "When you steal other people's belongings, you become a thief. This is very simple and clear. But people today think one becomes a criminal only after being arrested by a policeman, investigated by a prosecutor, sentenced by a judge, and confined in a prison. Therefore, corrupt politicians think they are men of virtue and skill if they can cover up their deeds and escape getting caught. They are heavily influenced by group stupidity." That's one of his favorite phrases, group stupidity. "Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and Genghis Khan were nothing other than great thieves. Hitler and Mussolini were greater robbers than the legendary thieves Ichikawa Goemon and Tenichi Bo. Although these dictators operated on a much larger scale, they were not fundamentally different from Kunisada Chuji, who said, 'Let's go as far as we can, no matter what.' And yet the henchmen of thieves think their bosses are respected. We're always falling into ruts. Politicians and their followers, many school teachers and opinion leaders, work hard to manipulate people into biased, habitual ways of thinking. The ways we're distorted are subtle, deliberate, and complicated. When we're liberated from this distortion, we will find the true wisdom of Buddhism." I'm going to read Uchiyama Roshi's commentary. He said, "Japanese today are forced to be stupid. Soaki Roshi called it group stupidity. It would be fine if prime ministers and other political, economic, and cultural leaders were truly esteemed people. But it's a problem if they're powerful only within the framework of conventional distortion. Buddha Dharma is a religion that allows practitioners to open clear and fresh eyes, unimpaired by habitual ways of thinking. To clarify the warped and deadly situation in Japanese politics, each and every one of us must open our eyes and criticize current conditions. Buddhism, in its true meaning, must be a living teaching in these times. I'll try to avoid what feels most easy to do. I want to talk about this, the last thing that Tsuwaki Roshi talks about, where he says, the ways we're distorted are subtle, deliberate, and complicated. When we're liberated from this distortion, we'll find the true wisdom of Buddhism. I want to talk about distortion for a second. I've had the opportunity, I usually take my dog for a walk pretty much every day in the neighborhood, and I listen to something, usually something, some kind of teaching. So I've been listening to this book, audiobook, recently. I'm almost done with it. It has a title that's kind of embarrassing to say out loud. I can't believe that they chose this title. But the title is Why Buddhism is True, which I hate this title. It makes me so uncomfortable. But I think that might be one reason why they chose it, to sort of get people to react. Anyway, it's written by a guy named Robert Wright. And Robert Wright is an evolutionary psychologist, which I didn't really know much about before I listened to this book. evolutionary psychology is basically what it sounds like. It's, you know, study of how our psychology is related to our evolution as a species. And one of the things that Wright talks about in the book, he asks the question early in the book, whether or not it's possible that for our feelings to not be true, which is a sort of a strange question to ask, because we always assume how we feel is just how we feel, right? Like, but he asserts that it's not only possible but pretty normal for our feelings in some way to be wrong. And the example that he uses that I'll also use because I can relate to it is he talks about a powdered sugar donut, which he's loves, according to the book. I also like donuts. So he says, you know, when you see a powdered sugar donut, when you see a donut or something like that you want, you feel good. And you imagine that you want that donut, you want to eat that donut, and some part of you feels like something good is going to come from eating that donut. Right? Intellectually, we know it's not true. We all know, I hope. If you don't know, we'll talk about it later. I hope you all know that donuts are not good. I mean, they taste good, but they're not good for you, right? It's like that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing for us to eat. But from the perspective of an earlier human being in a hunter-gatherer society or earlier than that, a donut is like a treasure. It has fat and sugar and all this kind of stuff that was pretty hard for them to get their hands on. And so a lot of the structures of our brain are left over from that kind of early evolutionary things. We don't evolve very quickly. We certainly don't evolve quickly enough to adapt to being able to go to Super America and buy a box of powdered sugar donuts, which happened, you know, that situation happened over the course of like 100 years. It's unbelievable, you know, what's happened. So his point is that feeling is wrong. That feeling is not true. The feeling that you want that donut's not true. And that might seem like a kind of, I don't know, mincing words or a kind of insignificant example, but it's not, because we're surrounded by situations like that all the time. And we're making decisions without questioning them all the time. So when Tsuwaki Roshi talks about the ways that we're distorted being subtle, deliberate, and complicated, it's really true. And it's true that our eyes are not open to this kind of thing most of the time. You know, even if we know, and there are studies that show this, it's amazing, even if we know, we're not foolish people, we know when we see an advertisement, we know exactly what they're trying to do. But it still works. It still works. They know it still works because they check it, because they spend a lot of money on that and they're not going to spend it otherwise. So, this meditation practice that we're talking about here often is an opportunity to observe how twisted our desire system is. Because it doesn't take very long, maybe even in only 30 minutes on Sunday morning, it doesn't take very long to find out that you don't want to be sitting here. There's some part of you, right, is like, oh, why did I come here? This is so boring. Or, you know, like, I am hungry. I didn't get enough coffee. Who knows, right? But maybe 30 minutes isn't long enough because I personally really like sitting. So, like, I find 30 minutes really enjoyable. That's very peaceful and pleasant. But if you come to Sesshin or you come, I shouldn't say this because I should be making more of a solid pitch for coming to my the Lee Lewis and I, our monthly lead, offering day-long sittings where all we do is sit for, you know, the whole day. If you come do that with us, and I encourage you to do it, you're going to find out a lot of things about why you don't want to be there. But that's interesting because some part of you does want to be there. Otherwise, you wouldn't have shown up, right? Like, and that's the exact same structure that's happening with the donut. Like, there's some part of you that's like, no, I don't want that donut. That's terrible. Another part of you that's like, ooh, I really want that donut. I wonder if there's another one. So, I'm going to leave that right there. I encourage you to think about that. That I think about it as sort of a desire structure, and like what you really want, and whether or not the actions that you're taking are moving you in the direction you want to go, or the direction that you're being pushed in by structures that you may not even be aware of unless you sit down and look really, really closely. Okay. That's what I'm going to say about that one. This is everyone's favorite saying by Soaki Roshi. We cannot exchange even a fart with another, can we? Each and every one of us has to live out ourself. Who's better looking? Who's smarter? You or I? We don't need to compare ourselves with others. And Uchiham Roshi's commentary on that is, Soaki Roshi spent his entire life devoted to Zazen. What is this Zazen that he expounded? In his early days, he often said, Zazen is the self selfing the self. Or, to practice Zazen is to be intimate with the self. In short, in our daily lives, we always worry about our relations with others, and we're absorbed in competition with them. To practice Zazen is to let go of these comparisons and just sit, being the self that is only the self. Soon the season for final exams and entrance exams will come. Some students will commit suicide because of bad grades or failure on these exams. This is a tragedy caused by our educational system, in which students are taught merely to compete with others. They are never taught to return to the self, which is the most important thing. Whether we defeat others or are defeated, we live out the self that is only the self. There's no way to become someone else. So we should return to the self with peace of mind. This is the practice of Zazen, in which we sit, quote, letting go of all associations and putting all affairs aside, as Dogen's Fukan Zazengi says. In the Sutta Nipata, Shakyamuni Buddha said, make yourself your refuge, walk in the world, and be unchained from everything. In Genjo Koan, Dogen Zenji wrote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Without being pulled every which way by comparing yourself with others, settle down within yourself in its true meaning. This is the essential way that Buddha Dharma pacifies our minds. And this is the most genuine Zazen practice. And there's one more sentence from Sawaki Roshi after that. It says, sit immovably in the place where being superior or inferior to others doesn't matter. And my teacher's commentary on this discussion is, when Uchiyama Roshi wrote this article in 1966, I was a high school student, and I was attracted by his comments on Japanese education. I wasn't happy at school. Education was very competitive. I was taught by my parents and teachers to study hard to enter a prestigious university. When I asked why, their answer was this: so I could get a good job, achieve a higher status on society's ladder, and make a lot of money. To me, all of Japanese society seemed like a huge money-making machine, with school as the factory producing the parts of this machine. If I became a good and useful part, my life would be happy and successful. Otherwise, my life would be a failure. I couldn't find any meaning in that life. I wanted an alternative way of living. Sawaki Roshi and Uchiyama Roshi seemed to understand my reservations about the educational system. I'm deeply grateful that I encountered their way of life and became their student. Nearly 50 years later, Japan has become one of the richest countries in the world, but more than 30,000 Japanese commit suicide each year. I'm convinced the system that demands young people work hard, compete, and get rich hasn't made the Japanese happy in the long run. Excessive competition is unwholesome for winners as well as losers. Those who lose may suffer a sense of inferiority, but winners also experience unhealthy effects, such as arrogance, that hinders them from working harmoniously with others. And when they finally encounter people superior to them, they can't escape their sense of inferiority. I hope school can become a place where young people can nurture their life force in a healthy way, enabling them to live on equal ground with each other. I think we're lucky that we don't live in quite such a competitive scholastic environment as that, although I think it can feel that way here too. I don't think it's quite as prevalent. I think it's a cultural phenomenon in the U.S. that people have opportunity to change things throughout the course of their lives, or at least some people do. But the point here, I think, is deeper than one particular cultural phenomenon or another. Uchiyama Roshi said, they're never taught to return to the self, which is the most important thing. I had a sort of vision a week or two ago where I realized, the question I asked myself was, what would happen if we had a president of the United States who had a serious meditation practice? And is that a possibility, or is that a crazy question to ask? And if that's a crazy question to ask, why is that a crazy question to ask? Why is it crazy for us to have lower expectations of people in those positions than we have of each other and of ourselves? It's bizarre. And I think the answer to that, the reason why that seems impossible is the same reason why it seems impossible that at school students would be taught to return to the self. You know, that doesn't have to be something about Buddhism. It's not. Buddhism doesn't have a corner on the market of, you know, understanding the universe or understanding ourselves. I think it's a pretty good way to do it. But it's definitely not the only one. You know, you could do it in a lot of different ways. So I'm not talking about bringing religion into the schools or something. You know, that's not my point. But what's the priority structure of a society where it seems, you know, Seamus kind of rolled his eyes at me when I said, "Oh, it's not quite that competitive here."
No, I know.
No,
it's
no, no, no.
That competitive. I know, no. I'm not. My point is that what's the deal with a society where it seems better to have a society, to have a situation where students feel that kind of stress than to teach them something about how to handle themselves in the world. I don't know. It seems sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe it seems unacademic to have that conversation about returning to the self, but I wonder about that. I wonder. What's unacademic about talking about reality? I don't know. This quote from the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the very, very earliest collections of the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha says, make yourself your refuge, walk in the world, and be unchained from everything. I thought of two stories from my teacher about when in that quote. One is not really a story, it's just a sort of funny thing that he always says. He doesn't have a cell phone. He says, I don't want a cell phone, it's like a leash. I don't want people to be able to find me. I think about that sometimes. And then I think about this story he told about when he was in high school. And he was sitting taking an exam in a room, the window. And outside the window were the tennis courts with a chain link fence. And he was sitting taking this exam, looking out the window, and he could see birds flying in the sky, but in front of the window was this chain link fence. And he felt like he was in prison. And these birds were flying in the sky freely, and he was trapped in this, trapped behind this fence. And so, this sounds like something, my son is in the room, so I shouldn't tell this story. But what he did was, by both my sons, what he did was, he erased all his answers on the exam. He turned it in and he left the room. And he left the school. And he walked for about an hour into the mountains. And he sat by a stream. And he describes that actually as his first. He didn't know anything about Zen or Buddhism at that time. His family was, they might have been Buddhist, but they didn't have any. He didn't grow up in that way. But he describes that as sort of his first, you know, awakening to the idea that there might be something he was missing, or there might be something more. And I think about this question of, the question in both of these things is, what are we talking about when we talk about the self? Returning to the self, or making yourself your refuge. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for those questions at all. But I think being comfortable with not knowing the answers to questions is something really valuable. It's something that I'm not very good at. But I think it's really valuable, and it's I think it's directly related to this, to the things that I was asking about. Why can't we have a president who has a meditation practice, or why can't we have schools that teach students something, that teach students to ask questions that there aren't answers to about who they are? And how you and how you might explore that. So, there's a quote here, another quote here from Sawaki Roshi. He's talking about the self here. He says, "What is the true self? It's brilliantly transparent, like the deep blue sky, and there's no gap between it and all living beings. I don't know if that's an answer to the question or not, but I really like it. So I'm going to leave that as my answer to the answer to the question about what the self is for the moment. Okay. This next little chapter, I'll read to you, goes like this. Human beings are strange. Although we have an intelligent look, we are simply groping in darkness. Human beings work diligently, merely to avoid boredom. There are too many things that attract us in this world. We want to do this and that. But once we experience or get these things, we find they're nothing important. There are people who never discover their own true way of life. And Uchiyama-roshi's comment is, if I broach the subject of the meaning of our lives, or what makes us feel like life is worth living, you might think I'm being preachy. But when we reflect deeply on our lives, we realize this isn't an academic question. Our accustomed ways of life lack vitality. We get up in the morning merely by force of habit, eat breakfast by force of habit, go to work by force of habit, meet people by force of habit, watch television by force of habit, and read magazines by force of habit. We spend most of our time in inertia. However, if we ask ourselves whether we live with meaning, most people would answer yes. Why do we feel our lives are worth living? We're always running after one thing or another so we can avoid deeply considering this question. When we play games, we find the significance of life in winning. When we go to a department store, we find the meaning of life in shopping. If we can't afford certain things, we find meaning in the fantasy that someday we'll be rich. When we watch sports on TV, we find the meaning of life in hoping our favorite athletes will win. These activities are merely diversions of the moment. No matter how noisy the modern world in which we live, I hope we can sincerely reflect on the meaning of our lives as a whole, instead of living by inertia. So, I think he wrote that in 1966, 1967. I wonder what he would write now. Yeah. Really? Some people know that one of my favorite topics in the world is boredom. I'm super fascinated by it. I find boredom very, very interesting. Because I still can't figure out what the problem with boredom is. None of us like it. We don't like to be bored. But I can't come up with why. I had the opportunity a few years ago to teach meditation at a high school over on the east side of St. Paul a couple times a week. I would get together with these kids. And this high school was sort of like, this is sort of a last stop kind of place for kids before they were sent off to some kind of juvenile delinquent facility. So these kids were honest with me. There were no games. And they were so funny. We had such a good time together. And we would sit together, I mean, honestly, for like 90 seconds. Three, you know. Maybe 90 seconds. And they would squirm the whole, I mean, like crazy, right? And afterwards I would say, what was that like? And they'd be like, that was boring. And I would say, okay, cool. So is that a problem? They'd be like, yes. And I would say, well, what was the problem? It was boring. And it's funny, but I can't come up with a better answer. Really, you know, like, what's wrong with being bored? We avoid it. We avoid it like crazy. I mean, I give these examples, like, you know, there are TVs on top of gas pumps. There are TVs, women don't know this, there are TVs in front of urinals in some places. Yeah. I mean, like, how long does it take to pee? Seriously. I don't know. But it's interesting. It's interesting, and So the question is, and Uchiha Maroshi gets into this a little bit. The question for me about boredom is, what are we trying to avoid? I think there's probably not one answer to that question. But there may be some, I think there's some common threads. For me, my suspicion is that we're trying to avoid, what did he say? We're trying to avoid? I can't remember what that was. But I don't know if I totally agree with what he said, but I can't remember what it was now. Oh, that we're trying to avoid asking the question, why do we feel our lives are worth living? I'm not sure I agree with that. I think we're trying to avoid the question of what our lives are. Because if your life isn't your job, and isn't your kids, and isn't your parents, and isn't your hobbies, and isn't your favorite foods, and isn't your favorite books, and I think when we look closely, we can see that's not what you're like. All of those things are impermanent. None of those things stick around. And in fact, your life doesn't stick around. Your life itself is impermanent, this body and mind. So it becomes a really uncomfortable thing to look at much more closely than just that, right? Because for me anyway, when I start to look at it like that, what I see is the only meaning there is there is the meaning that I assign, or the meaning of what I do. And so the responsibility comes back to me to decide how I'm going to live this life. And if we're spending our time avoiding asking that question, and most of us are, including me, my suspicion is we're spending a lot of time on things that don't add up to much. We're spending a lot of time on things that don't turn our lives into the thing we want our lives to be. Even though sitting zazen for all day can seem really, really like a super boring thing to do, for me there's a deep attraction to doing that because I don't know why. Like, it's hard to say why I have that attraction. I think it's because that moves me, that faces me in what I believe, what I have faith is, the right direction, a good direction of fulfilling my vows as a human being to try to support all other beings, to free other beings, we say, or to save all beings. But it's uncomfortable to do the things that move us in that direction. It's so much easier to play Candy Crush. Because there's no vulnerability in playing Candy Crush. So I'm going to share one more thing from this book, and then I'm going to be done. This is one of my favorite stories, and it's directly related to this question that I'm talking about. So Akiroshi said, "Once a monk asked Master Long Ya, how did the ancient master finally cease doing things and completely settle down? Long Ya replied, "It was like a thief slipping into a vacant house." And so Akiroshi's commentary on that story is, "A burglar breaks into an empty house. He can't steal anything. There's no need to escape. Nobody chases him. It's nothing. Understand, it's nothing." Satori is which is another Japanese word for enlightenment. Satori is like a burglar breaking into an empty house. Although he had difficulty getting in, there's nothing to steal. He doesn't need to run. Nobody's after him. The whole thing is a flop. When he talks about the burglar, so Akiroshi had a famous saying, that first thing that I read, he was talking about becoming a thief. When you steal something, you become a thief. And he often would say, he often would talk about Buddha nature and thief nature as sort of our two directions. And thief nature means when I look around at things, including enlightenment or Buddhist practice, and I see something that I want and I try to take it to make it mine, I'm a thief. It's as simple as that. But we also have Buddha nature, which means when we engage in Buddhist practice, when we act on our vows rather than on our sort of karmic inertia, then we manifest Buddha nature, 100%. My teacher always says it's both 100%. It's not that we're half thief nature and half Buddha nature. It's that we're at the same time 100% thief nature and 100% Buddha nature. And it's just a question of what we do. And neither one of them sticks around. You know, it's like we don't have a choice but to manifest that thief nature fairly often, right? Because we're greedy. We want stuff. You see something outside of you that you like, and you want it. You want the donut. You don't want to give the donut to the next person. That's not especially. Maybe you do. And if you do, that's good. That's Buddha nature. I think so, actually. It's hard to visualize or to imagine what it means to be simultaneously 100% two different things. So I should have brought this picture with me to illustrate this. My teacher always uses this drawing. You've probably seen this drawing. It's called My Wife and My Mother-in-Law. Have you seen, you know what I'm talking about? And depending on how you look at it, it either looks like a young woman or an old woman. Does everybody know that drawing? Kind of, yeah. And he uses that drawing because the drawing doesn't change. It's exactly the same, but depending on what you do with your eyes, you either see a young woman or an old woman. So it's at the same time, it's 100% old woman and 100% young woman. And it's like that with us, I think. 100% thief nature and 100% Buddha nature. And it just depends on what you do. Does anybody have any comments, questions, thoughts? Yes? What? We're done? I'm glad you don't have comments or questions.
We'll see you afterwards.
Yeah.